Mark chapter 6, we shall begin to read with verse 45 and read through verse 52. Mark 6, beginning with verse 45. And straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side before unto Bethsaida, while he sent away the people. And when he had sent them away, he departed into a mountain to pray. And when even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea, and he alone on the land. And he saw them toiling in rowing, for the wind was contrary unto them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he cometh unto them walking upon the sea, and would have passed by them. But when they saw him walking upon the sea, they supposed it had been a spirit, and cried out, for they all saw him and were troubled. And immediately he talked with them and saith unto them, be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. And he went up unto them into the ship, and the wind ceased. And they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure, and wondered, for they considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. Verse 48, he saw them toiling in rowing, for the wind was contrary unto them. And about the fourth watch of the night he cometh unto them walking upon the sea, and would have passed by them. Jesus saw them toiling in rowing, and Jesus sees you when you are toiling in rowing. To get a setting for this message, if we were to look back just a few verses, we would see that this follows immediately the feeding of the 5,000, 5,000 men plus women and children with five loaves and two fishes. Now the disciples were not just observers to that miracle, they were participants in it. For the little boy had brought his lunch to Jesus, and the word says that he looked up to heaven and blessed it and break it. And he break it and 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 gave it to the disciples. And they kept going out and coming back, going out and coming back, taking basketful after basketful of fish and bread to the people until they all were fed. How exciting it must have been to be a part of that miracle. And then when that was over, he said to the disciples, get into the ship, go over to the other side, while I send the people away. And then it says, after he had sent the people away, he went up into the mountain to pray. And then after that, it says, when the evening was come. So perhaps 3, maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Jesus said to the disciples, get into the ship and go over to the other side. They got into the ship and they started to the other side. At that point, there is no question that they were in the will of God because they were doing exactly what Jesus told them to do. It is evident as we read the story that Jesus is in control of the wind and the waves. So since he controls that, why didn't he provide a gentle tailwind just to blow them over to the other side? After all, that's what he told them to do. And he could have helped them get there by providing a wind like that, or a crosswind. For sailors know what to do with a crosswind. They sail this way and that way. It's what they call tack. They go first one way and then another until they get where they are going. If there had been no wind, it would have helped, because it says he saw them toiling and rowing. They did have oars on that ship, and they could have rowed across. But instead of a tailwind or a crosswind or a doldrum, the word says the wind was contrary unto them. A wind that would keep them from doing the very thing Jesus told them to do. Doesn't that seem strange? That when they were trying to do what the Lord told them to do, he allowed something to happen that would keep them from doing what he told them to do. Why? Was it because they were out of God's will? No, they were in his will. Was it because they were sinful? No, that wasn't it at all. It's because they were human. And as long as we are human, we will have contrary winds that blow against us in life. Now, I realize that runs contrary to what some people are teaching today. I heard a preacher say some time ago that when you serve Jesus, you never have any problems. I don't know where he got it, but I know where he didn't get it. He didn't get that out of here. You couldn't have made Daniel believe that, or the three Hebrew children, or Paul, or Jesus, or any of those listed in Hebrews chapter 11. They got in there because they had problems. But then, of course, in our enlightened age, we are taught not to say problems anymore. Did you know you don't have problems anymore? You have opportunities. It's a great opportunity. Well, I've had some opportunities that almost killed me. You can call them whatever you want to, but you're still going to have to come to grips with them and deal with them. Lincoln was in a discussion with a man, and he said to the man, "How many legs does a horse have?" And the man said, "Four." Lincoln said, "Well, suppose you call the tail a leg. How many legs does a horse have?" He said, "Five." Lincoln said, "No, calling a tail a leg does not make it a leg. A horse only has four legs." So you can call your problems whatever you want to, but that doesn't change the circumstances. Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7 provide some of the greatest teachings man has ever heard. It's called the Sermon on the Mount. As Jesus came to the end of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 7, the last four verses of the Sermon on the Mount, beginning with verse 24, Jesus said, "Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon a rock." He didn't say this man built a house. He said the person who hears the word of God, hears the sayings of the Lord, and does them is like a man that built his house upon a rock. He's talking about building our life, doing that which is right in the sight of God. And then in the 26th verse, he says, "And everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand." He's obviously talking about the sinner, the disobedient, the one who hears the word of God and refuses to do it. So Jesus is talking about the Christian and the sinner, the believer and the unbeliever, the obedient and the disobedient. Now, if that were being written by some today, it would have sounded something like this. There was this wise man that heard the sayings of the Lord, and he did them. He dug down deep and built his house upon the rock. And he had moonlight and roses, peaches and cream. The south wind blew softly, and he lived happily ever after. And there was this other fella who heard the sayings of the Lord. He refused to do them. He built his house upon the sand. He had tornadoes and typhoons, hurricanes and earthquakes, and it served him right, the scoundrel, because he knew better. But that's not the way Jesus tells the story. Verse 25 and 27 are identical. It says, "And the rain descended upon both of them, and the flood came against both of them, and the wind blew and beat upon both of them." It would almost sound like Jesus is teaching that the things that happen to a sinner could possibly happen to a Christian also. But surely he wouldn't teach us that. After all, if serving Jesus doesn't keep you out of trouble, then what's the use of serving Jesus? I thought that's why you served him, to keep out of difficulty. Well, I've known sinners who have died of dread diseases, but I've known Christians who have died of the same diseases. And I have known sinners who have had terrible accidents, but I have known Christians who have had just as bad accidents. I have known sinners that lost their job, but I've known Christians that lost their job. I have known sinners who have gone bankrupt in business, but I have known Christians that went bankrupt in business. I have known sinners whose house burned, but I have known Christians whose house burned. I have known sinners whose husband or wife left them, but I have known Christians whose husband or wife left them. You can't name anything that happens to the sinner apart from sin itself that may not happen to the Christian also. Well, then, if serving Jesus doesn't keep you from having problems, what's the use of serving Jesus? Well, never judge a story till you get to the end of it. The Chinaman said, "My horse ran away." And his neighbor said, "Oh, that's too bad, too bad." "No," he said, "that's good, because when my horse came home, a wild horse followed it home, and now I have two horses." The neighbor said, "Oh, that's good, that's good." "No," he said, "that's bad, because my son was trying to break the wild horse to ride. He got thrown off and broke his leg." The neighbor said, "Oh, too bad, too bad." "No," he said, "that's good, because right then they were getting an army together, and my son had a broken leg and didn't have to go to war." So don't ever judge a story till you get clear to the end of it. Jesus came to the end of the story when the rains had ceased and when the floods had receded and when the winds had died down. Here was one that was still standing, and Luke says it could not be shaken. And then he said of this one, "And it fell, and great was the fall of it." Jesus never once taught us that if we served him, it would be an easy life, but he taught us that regardless of what comes, we will be able to stand through the test, that he will give us victory in the time of testing. There will be contrary winds, whether you're saved or unsaved. The sinners have them too, but they don't have Jesus to see them through. There was a contrary wind. And then it says he saw them toiling in rowing. He saw them. They didn't see him. They didn't know where he was. The last they saw, if they look back as they set sail across the little Sea of Galilee, he was dismissing that great crowd and sending them home. They didn't know that he had gone up into a mountain to pray. They wouldn't have known where he was. But Jesus had pinpointed their position. You're never in a storm so bad and a night so dark with waves so high or wind so strong, but what Jesus knows exactly where you are. He saw them toiling and rowing. He was watching them. Now, I don't know what you do when you get in a storm, but I do what the disciples did. If the sails don't work, I pull them down and grab the oars, and I do the best I can with what I've got. I don't just sit there. I do what I can. There is a saying that goes like this: try something. If it doesn't work, try something else. I shared that with a group of preachers one day, and afterward, a young preacher came to me and said, "I think you'd like this one. It says, try something. If it doesn't work, you can always go back to what wasn't working before." Do you know what the seven last words of the church are? "We never did it that way before." Can't change. We have to do it the same way. I went to pastor a church that had not grown in over 20 years, rocked along at about 350 for over 20 years. I had three people in that church that knew every man, woman, boy, and girl in church because they hadn't had any new people come in for so many years. I hadn't been there long when we had a young evangelist come, he and his wife, and while he was preaching to us upstairs, she was working with the children downstairs. I thought it would be good if she came up and told one of the children's stories. Maybe it would encourage the adults to bring the neighborhood kids. So I invited her in the early part of the service to come share one of the stories. She didn't have those big puppets they use now, but just little hand puppets. And as she walked on the platform, she just ducked behind the pulpit and dangled those out over the pulpit and told her story. A few days later, one of the deacons came to see me. Now, he was better than 6 feet tall, and that's a disadvantage of being 5'7", is that so many people look down on you in life. And he came in and looked down on me and said, "Pastor, we have never done that in our church before." In all the years of that church, they had never once had a puppet in the sanctuary. And I looked up at him and said, "Brother, that is a statement of fact, but it is not necessarily a statement of policy. Just because we never have doesn't mean we never can. A few days after that, here came another brother, as big as this one, had a bigger job than this one had. He'd been in the church longer than this one had been. And he said, "Pastor, the other morning when you were preaching, you said, our church has not grown 10 per year for all the years it's been here. And when you said that, I thought, then it's time for us to do something different." I thought, isn't this strange? Two men sitting on the same board, sitting in the same church, hearing the same sermons, seeing the same things, and one of them says, "Let's don't do anything different. We've never done that before." And the other brother saying, "It's time for us to do something different." One night I came into a board meeting, and the Sunday school superintendent said, "This summer I'd like to have vacation Bible school under the big top." He said, "I have checked with a tent company, and we can rent a tent for $1,000. And I've checked with a lumber yard. They will lend us cement blocks and 2x12 planks." So he said, "We'll pitch the tent. We'll put those blocks under there and spread the planks on them. And the kids can sit there under the tent. And we'll have vacation Bible school under the big top." One of the men said, "Where would you put it? Everything we have is blacktop." He said, "Why, drill holes in the blacktop and stick the poles down in there and pitch a tent." And do you know they did it? They dug holes in our parking lot and put tent poles down there and pitched a big tent and enrolled 1,400 kids in vacation Bible school. They had never seen that many kids before. And then they stationed workers out there, and as the adults drove in to drop off the kids, they'd say, "Why don't you park your car and come inside? We have a class inside for adults." And so parents started coming to vacation Bible school at night. And when the VBS was over, we had whole new families that we had never seen before. And that church began to grow. They went on radio, and they bought new buses and vans. We started a church in a day. We sent out 85 people, gave them $35,000, and started a church in a day. And they were responsible for helping put Channel 38 on the air. Missions giving went from $25,000 to $109,000. Tithe went from $65,000 to $275,000. Attendance went from 350 to over 1,000. They had never done those things before. But once we attempt something for the Lord, He'll meet us there. And they dared to try some things different. They were toiling and rowing, and Jesus saw them toiling and rowing. And then it says about the fourth watch of the night. You go to the hospital at 3 p.m. You can't find a place to park. Everybody's there visiting. But if you go to the hospital at 3 a.m, parking is no problem. But if you could find the people that own those few cars that are out there, you'd have a story with every one of them. There's a reason they are there at that hour of the night, watching, waiting. I don't know why, but doctors will often say, if he makes it through the night, and the family will sit there by a baby or a loved one, a father, a husband, a son, a daughter, and weep and wait and pray their way through the night. Or you drive down the highway and all the lights are out, and then you come to that farm with lights on. And if you could look in there, you'd see a farmer sitting there at a desk. He's lived there most of his life. He's poured his life into this, and now it looks like he's lost it all. He's poring over the bills one more time to see if he can somehow salvage it. Some of you know what I'm talking about. You've been up at 3 o'clock in the morning, the fourth watch of the night. You've been up struggling in a spiritual battle or a physical battle or an emotional struggle or a broken relationship. Something's gone wrong. Maybe you're facing bankruptcy or the loss of a job and you can't sleep. Everybody else is asleep, but you're up. The fourth watch of the night, they should have been over there long, long before. Those of us who have been at the Sea of Galilee, it isn't all that big. It's only 7 miles wide at the widest point and only about 13 miles long. You can stand on the shores of the Sea of Galilee and look across it anywhere. They should have been over there before the sun went down, before dark. They should have been safely to the other side. And here they are still in the same storm. I grew up in Oklahoma and Kansas. And you know, around here we have tornadoes. There is one good thing about a tornado. It doesn't last long. You don't have to wonder what it's going to do. Just wait a few minutes and you can find out what it did. Now, for a time, we lived on the Gulf of Mexico, and down there, they had hurricanes. And in the days of television, they'll worry you to death with one of them. They'll come on the evening news and say there's a hurricane making up out here 500 miles off the coast. And you look at that thing, and they worry you with it. They say it's going to go past Cuba. It's going to go between Cuba and Florida. It's going to go up the coast. And every time you turn the news on, it's changed directions. And finally, it goes between Cuba and Florida and gets into the Gulf. And they say it's going to Mexico. And the next time you turn it on, it's decided to go to Louisiana. And the next time, it's going to Texas. And it just wanders around through there. And after a while, it decides to hit you after all. And for 3 days, it blows you this way. And then the eye passes. And for 3 days, it blows you back the other way. And you may have a tornado or two anyway. No, thank you. I'll just take the Oklahoma variety that comes and goes and gets it over with. Did you hear about the fellow who said his favorite Bible verse was, "And it came to pass"? He said, "Thank God it didn't come to stay." And I've had a lot of problems like that in life. I'm glad they didn't come to stay. But I've had some that lasted days, and I've had some that lasted weeks. And I've had some that lasted months, and I've had a few that went on for years. The storm just kept on howling, howling, howling against me. Some of those storms can be spiritual, and some can be physical, and some can be emotional, and some can be financial. I know what it's like to have bills you can't pay. And if you're the head of a household or the father or the mother, it gnaws on you when you go to bed, and it gnaws on you when you get up. It saps your very vitality. Broken relationships and all the storms that come against us in life, and sometimes they linger. They stay with us days or weeks or months. This storm had stayed with them from afternoon till 3 o'clock in the morning. They'd been in it for about 12 hours. And by then you remember that there were some who went out that didn't make it back. Perhaps loved ones or friends that had died in storms on the Sea of Galilee. Now it says about the fourth watch of the night, Jesus came to them. Really, what was their problem? Well, their problem was they had too much water. When they started out, they had water in front of them and behind them and on both sides and beneath them. And that's very good when you're wanting to go sailing. But as the night wore on, they began to get water in with them. And the waves were pounding and washing over that little ship where they were. And they were struggling against it with water all around. And what was it that brought Jesus to them? It was water that brought Jesus to them. He came to them walking upon their sea. And he often comes to us walking upon our trouble. And let me assure you that you never get into a storm so bad, with waves so high, but what Jesus is able to walk on your trouble. He's the master of the storm. He's the master of the sea. He's the master of the wind, and he can walk on your trouble. And he often comes to you walking upon your trouble. He came to them walking upon the sea, and it says he would have passed by them. Well, it must mean he pretended to pass by them. Surely he wouldn't go to all the bother of going out there on that dark night in this howling tempest and then go off and leave them out there, would he? Yes, it says he would have passed by them. Why? Well, because Jesus is a perfect gentleman. He never forces himself on anybody. He makes himself available to everybody, but he doesn't force himself on anybody. If you don't want to get saved, you don't have to. If you insist on it, You can spend an eternity in a devil's hell from which there is no escape. But you don't have to, because Jesus came, so you don't have to do that. But if you want to, you can. He came and made himself available so that you can spend eternity with him in heaven. But he isn't going to make you get saved if you don't want to get saved. And after you get saved, you don't always have to obey him. Jonah didn't, and God didn't make Jonah go to Nineveh. He just made him willing to go to Nineveh. And sometimes he does that to us too. In the book of 2 Kings, in the 5th chapter, beginning to read with the first verse, is a very interesting account. 2 Kings chapter 5, beginning with verse 1. Now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master, and honorable, because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria. He was also a mighty man in valor. Now there are some very interesting words in there. It says he was a captain, he was great, he was honorable, he was mighty, he was a man of valor. Five tremendous words about this man. And then it's all ruined with the last five words of the verse. It says, but he was a leper. What good is it to be a captain and mighty and honorable if you're a leper? And the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid. And she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said unto her mistress, would God my Lord were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would recover him of his leprosy. And one went in and told his lord, saying, thus and thus said the maid that is of the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, go, and I will send a letter unto the king of Israel. Now the girl had not said there is a king in Israel. She said there is a prophet in Israel. But the Syrian king, being a heathen man, thought if anybody over there can heal lepers, it must be the king. So he sent a letter to the king of Israel. And he departed and took with him, listen to this, 10 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, and 10 changes of raiment. What for? To give to the man that healed him of leprosy. 10 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, 10 complete changes of raiment. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, now when this letter is come unto thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman my servant to thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy. And it came to pass, when the king of Israel had read the letter, that he rent his clothes and said, am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man doth send unto me to recover a man of his leprosy? Wherefore, consider, I pray you, and see how he seeketh a quarrel against me. What he is saying is, the king of Syria wants to start a war, but he doesn't have any excuse for it. So he has sent this leper over here, and if I don't heal him, he will attack. Verse 8, and it was so when Elisha, the man of God, now that's who the girl was talking about, when Elisha, the man of God, had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him come now to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. So Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot and stood at the door of the house of Elisha. Now let me interrupt the story. We know what he thought, for in the 11th verse it goes on to say, I thought, he will surely come out to me. He will stand and call upon the name of his God. He will strike his hand over the leper, I'll be healed. Now that much we know he thought. Let me tell you what else I think he thought. I think as he left the palace and started toward the parsonage, he was thinking like this. When I get down there, he is going to be impressed with me. I doubt that he's ever seen a chariot as fancy as the one I drive. And he probably has never ministered to anybody as important as I am. And I doubt that he's ever had anybody who's going to pay him as well as I'm going to pay him. When I get down there, he will come out to me. He will stand and call on the name of his God. He will strike his hand over the place of the leprosy. I'll be healed. And then I'm going to give him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, 10 complete changes of raiment. He will be the best dressed and richest Pentecostal preacher in these parts when I get through with him. Boy, was he in for a surprise. The pastor had a summer intern working with him from Bible school that summer. And he said to this kid, "You go out and tell this man to go dip in Jordan 7 times. Now, you know, there are people who believe in the golden rule. That is, them what has the gold makes the rule. And this fellow was one of them. I have a friend who went to pastor a church in which there was a rich man. A few days after he got there, he heard a horn honk, and he looked out in front of the parsonage, and there sat the rich man in his big car honking a horn. A few days later, he saw the rich man, and the rich man said, "I was by the parsonage the other day, and you weren't home." "Oh," he said, "I was home." He said, "You were?" "Yes." "Well, I honked. I heard you." "You didn't come out?" He said, "No. Everybody else comes to the door, and you can too." Ooh. If you don't know how to handle money, somebody needs to teach you how. And that's all. He was just trying to teach this man that money doesn't buy your way in the kingdom. I had a man in my church one time that gave more than the whole church put together. And we were in a remodeling program. I stopped him one day to ask his opinion on something, and he gave me his opinion, and then he said, "Now, Pastor, that's just one man's opinion. But when it comes to running the affairs of this church, I have no more to say about it than the poorest widow who attends here." That's a proper attitude for us to take toward money in the church. At the cross, we're all equal, and money doesn't count. And if God has blessed you with money, pour it in like that brother did in our church. Pour it into the church, but don't use it as leverage. This man thought it... muddy river, ugly. And he knew that. He'd seen it. He'd been across it. And he said, are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of my land, better than all the waters of this land? And it says, he drove away in a rage. He's not going to talk to me like that. If that had been written today, they would have said, he laid rubber for half a block. He was getting out of there, mad, oh. And after a while, one of his servants said, Master, if the good man had told you to do some great thing, would you have done that? Yes, some great thing, but not this. Well, why don't you try it and see what'll happen? To his credit, he slowed down and he cooled down. And he turned aside to the muddy Jordan. And with his servants watching him, he got out of that fancy chariot. And he started wading out into that old muddy, muddy river. And he got out deep enough that he could go under. And he went under once and came up a wet leper. Nothing changed, but he got wet, that's all. But he went back 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times he went under. Still no change. But he went under one more time. And when he came up that time, he was healed. He was healed. But if he'd gone home without going by Jordan, he would have died a leper. The means was available, but he didn't have to avail himself of it. He didn't have to go to Jordan, but he chose to. And you don't have to accept Jesus. You can die in the leprosy of sin if you want to, but you don't have to, because Jesus came. Jesus went out where they were in the middle of the night, in the storm at sea, and he made himself available. He would have passed by, but it says, they cried out, and when they cried out, Jesus turned aside and said to them, be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. And he came up with them into the ship, and the wind ceased. Hallelujah. When Jesus comes in, it makes all the difference in the world. It was 18 years ago, last February the 11th, that our phone rang in the morning. I picked it up and answered it, and our daughter asked, is mother there? I said, she's on her way to the other phone. And when mom got on the phone, we heard our daughter say, happy birthday, grandma. That was the first word we had that our first grandchild had arrived. Well, they only lived a few hundred miles away. And what is a few hundred miles when you have a new grandchild? I have discovered that being a grandparent affects your sanity. And you do things you wouldn't ordinarily do. We got in the car and drove up there to see this wonder that had come into the world. They were in a hospital where they let visitors walk down the hall and look through the glass at the babies. And I was there early. When they moved that beautiful little rope from across the hall, I led the parade. I got down there first. And I said to the nurse, Deaton, Deaton. And she looked among the cribs and found one with D-E-A-T-O-N on it. And she turned it around and pushed it right up to the glass. And I laid eyes on the most beautiful little piece of humanity you will ever hope to see. Lots of black hair and an absolutely perfectly beautiful countenance. I know you probably think that's the opinion of a biased grandfather. But if you don't believe me, you just ask Priscilla and she'll tell it like it is. And I stood there taking pictures. I mean, I wanted to record this for all time because you don't see something like that every day. And I wanted to record that. And we stayed until they brought him home from the hospital. And I got to hold my first grandchild. And then I left Grandma to take care of mother and baby. And I went back to pastor the church where we were pastoring. She wrote to me and said, Ryan is spitting up. So what's new? All babies spit up. When my kids were little, I did not wear dark suits. I wore tweed because it doesn't show up on tweed, but it's over this shoulder, that shoulder, on this sleeve, that sleeve. I mean, that's a part of the equipment. So I didn't think much about it. But when they had had her long enough, and I felt I needed her more than they needed her, I drove back up there to get her. I had been traveling for hours, and I was weary with sitting, so I was leaning in the kitchen door, just standing there talking to them. Marilyn was sitting there feeding that tiny little baby, no longer than that, and he didn't gag or strain. He just suddenly erupted and blew a stream of vomit as far as from here to that piano. My eyes just popped out. I had never seen anything like this. And while I am standing there almost in shock, he does that a second time. Kerpow! I couldn't imagine. They took him back for his checkup, and the doctor explained he has pyloric stenosis. In all my years as a pastor, all the hospital calls I had made, all the babies I had dedicated, I had never one time heard of pyloric stenosis. Didn't know what it was, but it's a very common thing among boy babies. The muscle going out of the stomach into the intestine shuts off. Food does not pass through, and they develop what the doctors call projectile, like a bullet, projectile vomiting. And they explain to the kids he'll have to have surgery. And so they took him into the hospital and cut him open and cut those muscles to relieve that pressure. Marilyn called and said, "Daddy, if we bring Ryan over on a weekend, would you dedicate him to the Lord?" Now, would I dedicate my first grandchild? There are some things you take for granted. Is the Pope a Catholic, for instance? You know. Of course I would. And so they brought him on a Saturday. Sunday morning came. Marilyn was dressing him, getting him ready to go to Sunday school and church, when all of a sudden he erupts with this projectile vomiting again. And that morning, as I was conducting the service, and our daughter and son-in-law were sitting over here, my son-in-law holding that little baby with tears dripping down on him. Later he said, "For all I knew, I may have been holding a dying baby in my arms." We brought them to the platform, dedicated him to the Lord, and gave him back to them. They took their place in the audience. The next morning they were getting ready to return home. Our son and his wife were there. We gathered around, laid hands on the baby, and prayed for him. And then I moved behind the chair, and I laid my hands on Marilyn, and I started to pray for her. And as I prayed, I quoted this verse, "Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial that is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you." And as I quoted that verse, she started sobbing. When I finished praying, she said, "Daddy, I've heard people say the Holy Spirit impressed a verse upon them, but I'd never had that happen until a few days before Ryan was born. I was cleaning house one day when all of a sudden this verse, 'Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial that is to try you.'" She said, I stopped and said, "Lord, I don't understand this. I'm not going through any trial. I'm married to a fine young preacher. We're pastoring a lovely little church. We're looking for our first baby. I have never been happier. Lord, I don't understand this." But maybe that morning we were beginning to. They took him back home and took him to the doctor. The doctor examined him and said, "I've never heard of this recurring," but he picked up the phone and called a specialist in a large city. And the specialist said, "I've only heard of it two or three times, but he'll have to have surgery again." So they called to tell us that the baby was going into surgery. We drove up to be with them because we didn't want them to be alone. I'd never been around babies having surgery. They don't put a needle in the baby's arm like they do adults. They stick it under the scalp and tape it on. And the doctor was walking down the hall carrying the baby, the nurse walking along carrying this bottle of whatever it was, and a tube running down to the baby's head and a big knot swelling out on his head. And Daddy and Mama followed them, and Grandma and I came after them. They went through the doors that said surgery, and we waited a long time, and they came out and said it was worse than before, but we have it taken care of now. And when he has gained so many ounces, he can go home. But instead of gaining, he started losing weight. And while he was still in the hospital, he started this projectile vomiting again. the doctors sent him home and said to them, just prop him up at a 45-degree angle anytime you're not holding him, whether you're feeding him or whatever, just leave him at that angle. So if he vomited in his sleep, he wouldn't drown in his vomit. When he took him out of the hospital, they owed $2,000. This is 18 years ago. They asked that young preacher, how are you going to pay this? He said, cash in 30 days. There was no way. He only made $2,000 the whole year before. How could he come up with $2,000 in 30 days? But God began to supply. Money started coming in from people they'd never heard of. Neighboring churches took offerings and sent it. And in the end of 30 days, he walked in and counted out $2,000 and paid the bill in full. But the baby was worse. Another month passed, and he continued to linger. 3 months, he lived like this, starving to death slowly. 4 months, he developed an infection in his body. He looked like pictures you see of starving babies overseas, his little tummy bloated out like a volleyball, his arms and legs like little sticks, his eyes sort of pushed out of his face, and he just lay there, listless, almost lifeless. They called us every day to tell us his condition and to ask for prayer. The doctors talked to them and said, even if he lives now, he would be retarded because his brain has been deprived of nourishment for so long. And our daughter called weeping, saying, even if he lives, he'll be retarded. And so here they are, torn between a baby that may die any day or one that may survive and be retarded. And this went on for 5 months. 5 months that we were in the storm at sea when the night was dark and the waves were high and the wind was howling. And Jesus seemed so far away. I can remember getting alone, shutting myself in a room for a day and just staying there waiting on God and saying, God, what's going on? I don't understand. Are you trying to get through to me? And if you're trying to teach me something, then help me not to be so dense. God, I don't know what this is about. And we sought God earnestly with fasting and prayer. And the storm continued to howl around us. 5 months like that. And one day the phone rang as it did every morning. I picked up the phone. Marilyn was on it. Said, is Mother there? I said, she's on her way to the other phone. When Mother was on, Marilyn said, I've called so often to ask you to pray for Ryan. I just wanted to call and tell you that last night, Jesus touched him, and this morning, he's well. We only waited a few days, and we got in the car to drive up there to see him. Have you ever seen little pigs eat? I mean, little ones. They fight for it. You'd get a bottle close enough he could touch it. He'd grab that thing and pump it till it was dry. And he started filling out. They took him back to the hospital, to the doctors. The doctors examined him, and they said, we never expected him to live. By the time he could hardly talk, he could sing. His mother would sit at the piano and play the choruses and the songs they sang at church, and he'd stand there and sing those. Every one she'd play, he'd sing. I can see him standing there yet, singing, he touched me, oh, he touched me. And I'd sit there and weep because I realized if Jesus hadn't touched him, he wouldn't have been there. When he was 12, I didn't know how much of the story he might have known. And so I sat down on his 12th birthday and wrote him a long letter and told him the whole story. I told him that the doctor said he would be retarded if he lived. And I said, and now here you are, 12 years old. You play basketball and baseball. Soccer. You play the piano like a whiz. You play the trumpet. You have skipped the sixth grade. You're making top grades in seventh grade. And I ended by saying, not bad for being retarded. When he was 13, he was at home alone one night. A lady who had recently gotten saved called. Her baby was sick. She wanted the pastor to pray, but he wasn't there. And Ryan asked, would you want me to pray? And she said, oh, please. The next day she called back and talked to our daughter and said, I don't know who was at your house last night. I called the pastor for prayer and he wasn't there. Whoever was there asked if he could pray. And when I got back to the room where the baby was, the fever was gone and the baby was well. He graduated at the age of 17, a member of the National Honor Society. He was named the most valuable player in basketball and soccer and athlete of the year in his high school. Top grades. He plays piano. He won the teen talent competition in his district in piano and was named Mr. CA of the Year in his district. We go to their church and he sits like you kids sit, down toward the front. And he enters into worship and praise and prayer. And he loves Jesus with all his heart. He says the Lord has called him to preach. And I look at him and wonder, Lord, what are you going to do with him? You've poured so much into him. But I often think of those days when we were all alone out in the storm and Jesus seemed far, far away. And now I realize that all the while he saw us toiling and rowing, and he was on his way to where we were walking on our trouble. I don't know what kind of storm you're in tonight, but I know this, Jesus knows where you are. And you've never been in a storm so big that Jesus can't walk on it. And I know this, that he's coming to you tonight, walking on your storm. Let's worship him together.